We've kind of camped on James 1:12. In some ways, it's the pivot verse in chapter 1. And there are so many concepts that are tied in with this whole issue of blessedness because of testing and being approved and that kind of thing. And so a couple of weeks ago, we just focused on the issue of the blessedness because we were trying to make sure that we understood what he was promising, what he was saying. And we discovered in our study that the term blessed or blessed is a term in the New Testament that is used whenever a situation has come to pass. We've called it this, a post-action condition of being in line for glory or reward that cannot be revoked. And when we say it's post-action, what we mean is something has transpired at this point. It's done. It's an action that's been accomplished. But the person that was involved in that now is looking forward to the consequence of that reward. That is, the reward is the consequence of it, and it's irrevocable. And that's the concept of blessing, is that you're in a situation where something has already happened, and now you're waiting upon God's response to that with anticipation because of this thing that's taken place. And, of course, in James, it's persevering under trial, coming into these difficulties and persevering. In the Beatitudes, there were 10 or 11 different conditions addressed, being poor in spirit, for example, or being meek, or being persecuted for Jesus' sake, or there was a whole multiplied bunch of them. In the book of Revelation, it says, blessed are those who die in the Lord from henceforth. And he's talking about having your head cut off or being brutalized to death by the beast, the false prophet, and those people. So blessedness is not a situation that you look with joy upon the present circumstance. You look with joy on what God's going to do about it down the road. That's the reward element. And, of course, we stuck in this word irrevocable because of Jesus' statement that if you give a drink of water to someone in Jesus' name, well, then you can't lose your reward. It's irrevocable. Once it's done, justice requires that it be. However, that created a diversion last week because what we wanted to do was to understand blessedness in James 1:12, but we wanted to go into this question of how it can be a post-action condition given the human problem of boasting about what we do in order to exalt ourselves above each other and the theological doctrine of glory by grace, which is normally called salvation by grace, but I just have thrown it forward into the idea that salvation means glory in the future. This looks like that it's glory by works. The thing has happened, and you're blessed because now you're going to get the glory. But we pursued that last week and tried to come to this kind of a conclusion, and our conclusion was theological because we were going all over the place. But post-action conditions, that is, the individual who's after the fact, the thing has taken place, require, if there's going to be an irrevocable reward, this situation requires that the action itself be characterized by several things. Number one, it has to be an action that's what the Bible would call the fruit of faith. It's an action that springs out of being convinced of the truth. Actions that spring out of being convinced of lies, of course, cannot be rewarded. Actions that spring out of a false sense of confidence in the wrong object cannot be rewarded. So the only rewardable acts that the Bible recognizes are acts that God can reward because they were acts done in confidence on what He said and on the basis of the truth. However, actions that are taken, what we would call faith actions, are not by themselves rewardable. I mean, you can act by faith to accomplish a thing and do it for the wrong reason, 1 Corinthians 13:1-2, and it's not rewardable. So, in addition to the fact that it has to be faith-based, it also has to be motivated and empowered by the Spirit of God, because the only way we can be loving is by the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is love. Just as an aside, and this is another reason why we never get anywhere in our studies, because there are too many asides, but do you know that in 1 John, John makes this statement, "He that loves is born of God." And you know what the world does with that? Well, anybody that's ever loved anybody is born of God, and that's what John says. However, their understanding of that is totally wrong, because love, according to the New Testament doctrine, is impossible for anybody that doesn't have the Spirit of God. The love is the fruit of the Spirit of God. What the world calls love is not what God calls love. We see two unbelievers, and they seem to get along very well. They're compatible. They love each other. That's what we say. And they say, "We love each other," and so on and so on and so on. But what's really going on in that relationship is a mutual, you scratch my back, I scratch your back kind of relationship. And that's why the world's love can't work indefinitely, because at some point or another, somebody's going to want to quit scratching. And that makes the other one want to quit scratching. And that proves it's not love. It's, I'm doing this because of what you do for me. And all our country western singing is a perverted sense of, I can't live without you. That's idolatry. That's not love. But it's called love. So we have to understand that what the scriptures refer to when they talk about love, that's something God sees as an honest motive of righteousness and holiness and genuine interest in the other person's eternal well-being. That's the way he defines love. And that's only possible for a person who's walking by the Spirit, because love is the fruit of the Spirit. That's the whole point. And that's why the world can't do it, because the whole world's self-centered. And if they're not going to get anything out of it, they're not very often willing to put anything into it. It's exactly that, the problem. It's conditional on what I get. So, the point is, for it to really be rewardable, God sees this, and he sees what motivates it. So that, in order for it to be rewardable at all, revocable or irrevocable, whether it can even be rewarded at all, means that it has to pass muster under the eye of God, as being motivated by faith and energized by love. And then, of course, there's one other thing, and that's informed by the Word of God. Because the whole issue of God giving us an inspired, inerrant testimony, his word, is so that we won't be confused by the impulses of emotional feeling. We can't tell sometimes what real love is until we see in the Bible what it says real love does, and then, because we're emotionally involved and we can't discern the motives and intentions that are confused behind our emotional makeup. So it has to be informed by the Word. Those three things taking place create a rewardable situation that is irrevocable, so that the person is blessed who meets those standards. Now, that's theology. That's not what verse 12... Well, verse 12 says that in so many words. For example, the motive issue is at the end of the verse. To those who love him, so the love is brought in. And the whole idea of receiving the crown of life which the Lord has promised means that there's a promise, there's actual communication, verbal word given, and you respond by faith to that word because it's a word of promise that you can believe. So it's really here, it's just not as explicit perhaps as we'd like it to be on occasion. But that's foundation, and I want us this evening to go on. We know that the individual that is involved in a post-action rewardable situation is a person who, being directed by faith in the Word of God and motivated and empowered by the Spirit of God, sees a work accomplished through his life that he can take no credit for, because it was the Spirit of God who made it possible for that work to take place. So his reaction, instead of boasting in what he's accomplished, is exulting with gratitude toward God because of what God has accomplished and what he's going to do for him down the road. So that's the theology that's behind this whole idea. This evening what we want to do is to pursue the crown of life and see what the nature of it is and what the conditions of it are, what it requires to get the crown of life. Now, the whole issue of talking about the crown of life is going to get us kind of bogged down here, but I want us to go ahead and get bogged down and see if we can figure out what this means. If you don't understand the meaning of a promise, it has no power to give you motivation. If you don't know what you're looking for, if God makes this phenomenal promise, but you don't know what it means, it's not phenomenal to you. It's just, well, I don't know. And as a consequence, you can't be motivated. You got to know what you're looking for. You got to know what God means by the promise he makes in order for you to be motivated. I mean, promises are given so you can believe them and so that they can provide a certain kind of motivation. So what is the crown of life? Well, I think we'll start with the word crown because immediately the issue of the crown of life gives us what I would call a linguistic tension. It gives us on the one hand a material object, on the other hand an immaterial reality. Crowns of material object, life is an immaterial phenomenon. So when we talk about the crown of life, one of the first things we've got to do is to try to decide what God is promising us here. Is he going to give us a crown with the word life written across the front of it? Or what? And even if he does, even if the crown of life turns out to be a real crown with the word life stamped across it, is that all it is? Something to put on your head? Well, most of us would say, no, that's not worth troubling about. And verse 12 is talking about persevering under trial. And we're not going to persevere under trial for a chunk of iron or gold or whatever it is sitting on top of our head. That's obviously not what it means. So one of the things that we have to realize is that when the scriptures speak in figures of speech, we have to decide what the meaning is. And most of us will talk about it in terms of literal or non-literal. But what do we mean when we say literal? What is a literal crown? What does literal mean? Okay. Literal means material, something that the five senses can interact with. That's normally the way we use the word literal. When we talk about something being literal, we're talking about some kind of a physical, empirical correspondence between the literal and the description of it. If we say this is a literal lion, well, we expect to see an animal over there. But you know, I've discovered that most good words in the English language have been twisted. In our conversations, for example, if I tell you that I was driving down the freeway and somebody pulled on the entrance ramp and they were only going 10 miles an hour and they just pulled right over in front of me and I say, I literally had to stand the car on end to get it to stop. What do I mean by literal? You picture, because I said literally, you picture this car like this. Well, is that even possible? No. So literally doesn't mean literally anymore. You can't take it literally. You can't take literal or literally literally. So what has happened is in our generation with the word literal, we have actually turned it into a word that simply adds emphasis to our description. It doesn't mean literally. It just means I want you to graphically picture this thing I'm telling you in your mind. That's basically what it boils down to. But I want us to go back to the old idea that the concept of literal is some kind of material reality. And we still use the word literally that way. If I say that tire is flat, and I mean literally, what I mean? It's flat. It needs air in it. So, when we talk about this crown of life, are we talking about a literal crown? A material crown? Well, how do you decide? The problem is that you have a material phenomenon possible in the phrase, but then you have this life thing, and this is not material. Now, when you have a mixed metaphor, and that's what it is, a crown, material, of life, immaterial, which one carries the day? I mean, is it material or is it immaterial? How can you have a crown of life when life isn't material? You can have a crown of gold. You can have a crown of stone. You can have a crown of cast iron. But how do you have a crown of life? I believe, personally, that the phrase crown of life is a figure of speech. Now, I'm not going to object if in the day, if I have qualified, if the Lord himself gives me a material thing to put on my head, I'm not going to object, but that's not going to be the fulfillment of this promise. I think that most of us would agree that if it's a literal physical material phenomenon, a crown that somehow represents the crown of life, it's still a representation of something else. That's kind of like the phrase in Romans 6 where it says, you're baptized into Christ. It's amazing how many people run to water right here. And they say, well, when I was immersed or sprinkled or dunked or dipped or poured, I got into Christ. Well, that's not what that says, because baptism is not automatically in water. The scriptures talk very clearly about a baptism by the Spirit into Christ, and you can't get into Christ by going into water. So it's going to break down somewhere because people don't recognize that when you have something that can be physically done and something that can't be physically done, you've got to decide which one carries it. And typically, if there's something non-material involved in the figure, this is where the real focus is. The crown's immaterial. The life's what's critical. I just used these two illustrations to show you that we have to do some thinking about the words we're reading, because I really want us to be motivated by this crown of life. But until we know what it is, what's the motivation? So let's consider this then as something that has to do with life that a crown is the best illustration of. Now, there are two kinds of crowns in the scripture. One of them is a what we would call a diadem, which is a crown of royalty. When you see a diadem, you know you're looking at a king or a queen. Then there is the victor's crown, which is actually originally was a wreath that the Olympians were awarded when they won the Olympic effort, and this was done in Corinth. Well, the word that's translated crown here is this one. It's not the royal crown. It doesn't have to do with sovereignty. It doesn't have to do with the opportunity to rule. Now, I believe that there is a diadem believers are going to function in regard to, because he said we're going to reign and rule with him. But the text here is talking about the victor's wreath. Now, what is a victor's wreath? Who gets it? The winner. Paul argues in 1 Corinthians that based on the observation of the games, you know that you have to be self-disciplined and you have to be very committed to winning, because there are many that are competing and only one can win. Well, that's true when it comes to the 100-meter dash, or the decathlon or whatever. Only one can be a winner unless you have a dead tie. But the whole idea here is the victor's wreath is a symbol. Even when they put it on your head, it's still a symbol. It's a symbol of having overcome all contenders with you. That is, people who contend or things that contend with you. For the prize. That's what a victor's crown was. It's a symbol that you beat the adversaries, the contenders. Now, I want you to put that in the context of life. What are the contenders that contend with you over this issue? Well, I believe they're the forces of death. In order for you to get to life, you've got to win over these contenders who would have you die. Now, they think that by having you die, they'll live, but that's the whole satanic twist. He thinks he's going to live if he wins. But when you're immersed in death and your whole program is death, even if you win, death's still your end. But my point is, in James 1:12, when he talks about the person who gets the crown of life, he's talking about a situation in which death has been making moves on you to try to beat you out of life. And the only person who's going to get the crown of life is the person who overcomes those contenders. Well, what are the contenders? Well, wait a minute. Before we ask that, what is, in the final analysis, what is the life? Now here you're going to have to appeal to your theological understanding of the whole idea of life, but we've defined life in this series of studies as essentially, if this is life, this is at the core of it. Joy is the difference between life and death. If you have joy, you got it, and it doesn't matter what you don't have. If you don't have joy, it doesn't matter what you do have. You don't have life. So this is the core. Now, the mechanism of joy in the scriptures, if this is life, the mechanism of this, which is the core of it, is relationships. This is where joy comes from, relationships. But they have to be harmonious relationships. Conflicting relationships produce death. They don't produce joy. So, when we are talking about the crown of life as a reward from God for those who love Him, the whole idea of love Him is a relational issue, and He is the essence of the relationship that produces the joy, because at His right hand are joys forevermore. And those who love Him are the ones who have entered into this uniqueness of relationship. So that joy is that emotional reality that just overwhelms two that are in a relationship where there is no conflict. You're in perfect harmony, you're in perfect peace, you have the same agenda, you're going after the same thing. And when God's the other in this relationship, the joy is immeasurable. That's why it's called joy inexpressible and full of glory. Well, that's the crown of joy, or crown of life. It's the fullness of joy that comes out of this relationship with God. So, the crown of life would imply that it's a greater level of this relational harmony and joy than the average. I mean, you have the average, and then you have the crown of life. But see, in James 1:2, where's this focus? And in James 1:9, exulting in your humble circumstances, or glorying in 10, this is the focus. So all the time, He has been dealing with us on this issue of where life is, and its joy through a relationship with God. But as a crown, it would be something that was more than average. People don't get the crown unless they win. Now, does that mean then, let me ask you this theologically, does that mean every believer is going to get the crown of life? Obviously not. Verse 12 says you have to persevere under trial to get to this. Are there believers who don't persevere in the trial? Absolutely. Do they go to hell when they die? No. But they don't get the crown of life. The crown of life is an extra degree or an extra measure. And I believe that's why it's presented to us as a crown. This is an extraordinary measure beyond the normal. Now, we're going to run out of time before I cover everything I want, so I may become pretty selective here in a little while about what I'm going to cover. Now that we know that the crown of life is an extraordinary measure of joy through relationship with God, this ought to make us understand a little bit better the promise that Jesus made in one of the letters to the churches in Revelation, that He was going to let some of them be pillars in the temple. And they'd never leave. Some people say, oh, how boring. Well, yeah, if relationship is not your thing, you'd be bored to death locked into one that tight. But what if it's the very core of your everything, your whole value system? Well, being able to be with him without ever leaving him suddenly becomes a very appealing thing. So, it's an extra measure through relationship. Now the question is, how do you get there from here? Well, according to verse 12, he introduces this issue of persevering under trial. And then he says, for once he has been approved. The King James says once he's been tested or tried, but that word means approved. It means that something real has been revealed as real. In other words, in the economic realm, this word translated approved was a word that Dr. Barnhouse said this about. He said, in the ancient world, there was no banking system as we know it today, no paper money. All money was made from metal, heated until liquid, poured into molds, and allowed to cool. When the coins were cooled, it was necessary to smooth off the uneven edges. The coins were comparatively soft, and of course, many people shaved them closely, more than necessary. In one century, more than 80 laws were passed in Athens to stop the practice of shaving down the coins then in circulation. When a coin's weight is based on the metal it's made out of, the weight of how much metal is there is critical. So a crook could shave off a little bit, and if you shave off a little bit over a lot of... The whole point is that something was approved if it was full weighted. If it passed the test of putting it on the scale and it passed the weight test. Well, in James, what's going on? The trial business is a test of what? Verse 3. Test of faith. So the trials are designed to do what? They test the reality of the faith. Now, why does faith have to be tested for reality purposes? I can think of four or five reasons right off the top of my head. Number one, because it's easy to say what you believe and make it true that you believe it. Has to be tested. Anybody can say they believe something, but until they're slammed up against the wall and have to hang on to that in order to survive, then you'll find out what they believe. So that's one thing. Another thing is that oftentimes professions of faith are designed to be manipulative. People claim to believe things because of what they can get out of other people if they claim to believe those. And that kind of faith is fake. And so on. So my point is, faith needs to be tested to prove the reality of it, because you see the reality when the person that's claiming to believe a certain thing is being pressed by his circumstances to hang on to that thing that he believes. And that's what verse 12 is talking about, persevering under trial. The trial is simply pressing you to prove the reality of the things you say you believe. And, of course, Satan wants you to cave. And God wants you to come through having that faith purified like gold in the fire. Paul said, we glory in our tribulations. You don't go out looking for them, but you don't shy away from them because you know who you believe. So, that's one of the issues. The trials are designed to test. But I want to point out a couple of things before we run out of time. Number one, the crown of life is not for the person who passes one test. Verse 12 is not talking about passing one test to get the crown of life. Verse 12 is talking about becoming approved. I believe the crown of life is the consequence of the life, the whole life, lived in view of the development of this kind of relationship. In other words, there's only going to be one standard by which this whole test will be judged, and that is if at the end you're completely committed to the relationship you have with God above everything else. And if you are, you get the crown of life. And if you're not, you don't. And generally speaking, what happens is the trials come in a whole long line of them called our life here. And in every trial, we're being pressed to answer this question. Would you rather be walking with God in this thing or walking without Him out of it? That's the question. And whatever you answer tells you where you are in relation to how important relationship with God is. If you'd rather speed than be in fellowship, you're saying I'd rather go fast than be with God. In every area. And this is where believers have really got to buckle down and ask the right question. Because I talked to a guy yesterday who told me that he was a very successful businessman, and under God's sovereignty, he lost his whole business, and he got so mad he walked away and stayed away for 8 years. Told the Lord, I ain't having nothing to do with you. If you want me back, you're going to have to kill me. Well, what was he saying? I'd rather have my money than my relationship. Well, you ain't going to get the crown of life if that's the conclusion of your life. But what I want to say also is that you don't lose the crown of life by occasional failures along the way. Occasional failures along the way can be made up for if you learn from them. I mean, you know, if you fail too many times along the way, then obviously you're saying, look, God, you're asking more than I'm going to pay. Let's just forget about this relationship business. Now, the other thing that I want to get in under the wire is this. Paul said, for example, in 2 Timothy 4:8, there is a crown of righteousness awaiting me, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day. Why? Well, verse 7. I fought the good fight. I've finished the course. I've kept the faith. Now, is anybody going to get the crown of righteousness that doesn't finish the course? No. Does that mean he's going to perish? No. It means he's not going to get that crown. Can you get the crown of life and not get the crown of righteousness? Careful. Let's suppose, what was Paul's course? Well, his course was his apostleship. That was his divine stewardship. He was required as a steward to be faithful. He talked about being put on the shelf, which would mean he didn't finish his course. All right, what do you do then with an individual whose course is, for example, he's got the gift of evangelism and he's an evangelist. All right, let's suppose that in the weakness of the flesh, he gets involved in some moral scandal and it destroys his ministry as an evangelist. Can he finish his course? No. Is he going to get the crown of righteousness? No. Can he get the crown of life? Yes. If your fall from your course humbles you to the point where your relationship with God is more important to you than any other thing, then you're going to get the crown of life, but you're not still not going to get the crown of righteousness because you got to finish your course to do that. If you don't finish your course, you don't get that crown. So there are, you know, there are some things about the Christian life that are, hey, you can lose it. You can lose it big time, and there's no recovery in that particular area. But there are other things, like the crown of life, where the real question is going to be at the end, whether at that point you have finally come to the point in your relationship with God that He is your all. And if you have come to that point through the process of your trials, you will get the crown of life. There will be people who will be in heaven who haven't ever gotten there. They won't get the crown of life either. Like, for example, 1 Corinthians 11, the people who God slew because they were taking part in the Lord's table with sin in their life. They were saying, my relationship with Him is so important to me, but they were living in contradiction to that, and God got tired of hypocrisy and killed them. Well, they went to heaven. But when they got there, they discovered that they hadn't been nearly as interested in relationship as they should have been. So what James is driving at in James, it's different than what Paul is driving at in 1st and 2nd Timothy, but what James is driving at in James is just how important is your relationship with God. And there are many death competitors, many things that are trying to get in there and be more important to you than your relationship with the Father. And the person who gets the crown is the one who overcomes the competitors. Question.
Maybe you can't get into it tonight. Maybe you're going to get into it later. But is there a difference then between the relationship and fellowship?
Well, of course, the relationship should be a relationship of fellowship. Otherwise, and I'm using them together, the same thing. Because relationship with God, I'm talking about a harmonious, open, interacting relationship. Yeah, which is what fellowship is. You can have a relationship as a child of the Father and be fellowship completely off. You have this relationship of a child of the Father, but you don't have fellowship with Him. I'm not using relationship in that way. I'm using it in the fellowship term. But we're pressed by our daily experiences where God says, this is what I want. And you say, man, I don't want that. And He says, well, how important is my relationship with you? And you say, well, it's not fair. He always gets what He wants. Yeah, but He always gets life. Life is why He tells us these things, and He wants life for us. We think that these death things over here are more interesting, but He knows there's death in that pot, there's life in this one. And so the real question always, in every test, the real question is, well, how bad do you really want to maintain this open, free, unconflicting relationship with your Father? That's the question. Because in every stress, there is the will of God, and then there is a way to get the stress to lighten up some.
Yeah, strategies.
Strategies of men to get out from under the difficulties. Okay.